Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In a topsy-turvy world, we bring you the comforting stability of two guests in two segments. Today, one topic, Israel's war in Iran. Moeen Rabbani, in a return engagement, looks at the regional and global angles, and Joel Shalit will explore the multiple pathologies of Israeli society. Israel's attack in Iran, while not surprising, is still very distressing to anyone who imagines a day when humans can live in peace with each other. Heavily armed and funded by the U.S., it is, as Moeen Rabbani will say in this interview, a regional arsonist. It is now bombing at least five countries, the genocidal campaign in Gaza, of course, but also Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and now Iran. A country founded in violent displacement of the Palestinian population 77 years ago, it has continued to wage war on them and its neighbors with little pause. At first, the Trump administration looked like it might keep some distance from this latest front, but support for Israel, like hatred of Iran, is so embedded in American politics that Washington quickly turned cheerleader and an increasingly likely participant. What is Israel's aim in this latest war of aggression? We've got two perspectives on that. First, Moeen Rabbani, making a return appearance after only the briefest of rests. Moeen's knowledge of the region is hard to surpass. He has served in several diplomatic roles over the years and is co-editor of Jadalia, where he also hosts his Connections podcast. Moeen Rabbani. Just before I pressed the record button, I got a bulletin saying that Trump is now demanding unconditional surrender from Iran. They started out distancing themselves from the operation, and now they seem to be cheerleading. Are there divisions with the administration? Are they a bunch of incompetence? Or is Trump just getting behind what he sees as a winner? How do you read what the U.S. position is?
To take a step back, to understand what's currently happening, you have to believe one of two things. Either that the Trump administration intended to go to war with Iran from the very outset, and the whole issue of diplomacy and negotiations with Iran and seeking a negotiated agreement was all a ruse, was all camouflage for the real policy. Or you have to believe that the Trump administration genuinely wanted to avoid war and sought to achieve an agreement with Iran, but was then persuaded first to present Iran with an offer it couldn't accept, and was then sold on the idea that a short, sharp decapitation strike by Israel against Iran should be supported because it would weaken Iran's negotiating position and compel the Iranian leadership to accept whatever the U.S. wanted, and that now the U.S. is being persuaded that just one massive Iranian airstrike would, first of all, avoid what happened in Iraq and would solve the Iran problem once and for all. I tend towards the latter, that the U.S. instrumentalizing diplomacy in order to provide cover for war really only started a few weeks ago. And that when the Trump administration first assumed office, in contrast to its posture in 2017, it wanted to explore the possibility for a negotiated agreement and avoid a costly, bloody entanglement in the Middle East. But it appears to have been persuaded by a combination of Israel and neocons and Iran hawks within the administration and more broadly within Congress in the U.S., that belligerence not only is the way to go, but that it would be very effective, essentially cost-free and painless. And that's why we're now on the cusp of what appears to be an increasingly inevitable direct U.S. attack on Iran. I should say the U.S. has been involved in this from the very beginning because, of course, it supplies all the arms Israel has been using, has been supplying massive amounts of intelligence, is providing unconditional political and diplomatic support, and, of course, is directly participating in defending Israeli airspace from incoming Iranian retaliatory strikes. But we're now really talking about transforming what has been a U.S.-supported Israeli war into a U.S. war conducted on primarily on Israel's behalf.
Trump says it's against forever wars, but he seems to have signed up for a new front in one. How do we reconcile these things?
Well, I think the first thing you need to recognize is that Trump is not particularly smart. He's not particularly adept at foreign relations. He knows about as much about Iran as the microphone that I'm using to speak with you, and is very easily persuaded by the last person he's spoken with. And I think that's also why you see all these contradictory statements from one moment to the other. But in this case, if you look at it from Trump's perspective, he is against forever wars, but he has been persuaded and persuaded himself that you can have war with Iran and that it won't be a forever war, that it won't be costly, that it won't damage the U.S. economy, that it won't set the region on fire, that it won't potentially draw in other countries in the region or the Russians or Chinese. You know, there's a whole series of assumptions here that this is not going to be Iraq, where all the indications are it may well end up making Iraq look like child's play, that it won't escalate into a regional conflict where all the indications are that it will set the entire region on fire. And perhaps most importantly, this assumption that the Iranian people are begging for this because they're just waiting for the right moment to rise up and overthrow the Islamic Republican regime, where all indications are, not just from Iran, but from most examples that we're aware of throughout history, that foreign aggression, and particularly indiscriminate foreign aggression, tends to make people rally around the flag, tends to make even critics who detest their leadership to either lay low or rally around what they see not as a regime being singled out for attack, but a state and a nation being subjected to foreign aggression in order to dismantle the entire state.
That rally around the flag seems to be happening in Israel, too. Netanyahu was pretty bad political trouble, and now that the missiles are falling, that may have changed some.
I would make an even more germane point, which is that of all people, it's the Israelis who should know about this, because as you may recall, on October 6th, 2023, Israelis had been demonstrating in growing numbers against their own government and calling for Netanyahu to be deposed because he was seeking to legislate measures that would make the Israeli judiciary even more subservient to the Israeli government. And this was seen by many, arguably by most Israelis, as a direct assault on the state and so on. But then Hamas attacks of October 7th happened. Was Netanyahu deposed or overthrown on October 8th? No, quite to the contrary. Israelis, even his fiercest critics, all rallied around him, got in their U.S.-supplied jets, and started perpetrating a genocide in the Gaza Strip.
Iran isn't terribly popular in the region or around the world, so how much quiet satisfaction is there in seeing the country bombed?
It's a very difficult question to answer. On the one hand, the Iranian regime is not only unpopular within Iran, I think it's fair to say that the leadership of most of the surrounding states would be quite happy to see it disappear or replaced. The problem here is that over the course of the past decade, and particularly as a result of the policy of maximum pressure pursued by the first Trump administration, Iran's neighbors, and particularly those who were previously the most hostile to it, and here I'm referring to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, have come to the conclusion that the cost of getting rid of this regime is going to be prohibitively expensive and will place them directly in the firing line. So you look at Saudi Arabia, for example. During the first Trump administration, the Saudi crown prince and de facto ruler, MBS, was putting out TikTok videos showing Saudi troops marching through the center of Tehran. Then you had this very sophisticated Iranian drone and missile attack on the key Aramco facilities in eastern Saudi Arabia. And then you had the Houthis, who received substantial Iranian technical assistance, launching drones and missiles directly into Saudi territory and later also Emirati territory during the Yemen war. And just as, if not more importantly, you had the United States unwilling or unable to defend their Arab client regimes from these Iranian and Iranian-supported attacks. And so you saw a real change of attitude where Abu Dhabi and Riyadh not only normalized their relations with Tehran, but also began encouraging the U.S. to pursue a diplomatic resolution with Iran. And we saw that very clearly when Trump recently visited the Gulf. So both sentiments can exist at the same time. I may detest you, but I realize that if I pick a fight with you, I'm going to get a broken nose, so I'm going to seek third-party mediation to resolve our differences.
They keep saying Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. And every time they say that, I think that's all the more reason Iran might want one. The U.S. and Israel would have a lot harder time pushing the country around. They certainly wouldn't do this to North Korea. Will other countries looking at this look at this and say, God, I could use a nuclear weapon too?
North Korea is exactly it. I think many people in Iran will be looking at this now, in fact, have been looking at this and saying, why is this aggression directed against us? And there hasn't been a U.S. attack on North Korea. Well, answer is a two-word answer, nuclear bomb. And so you're seeing, I suspect, growing pressure on the Iranian leadership to cross the nuclear weapons threshold. I think it's important also to understand what this is about. Israel is the only nuclear power in the Middle East. For, you know, all the obsession about Iran developing a nuclear weapon, we have to remember that there is only one country in the Middle East that has a nuclear arsenal, and a very extensive nuclear arsenal, and that is Israel. And what this war is ultimately about is about preserving and maintaining Israel's nuclear monopoly in the Middle East. And that means not only preventing any other country in the region from developing a nuclear weapon, but ensuring that no other country in the region has the capacity to develop a nuclear weapon, should it so choose. And Iran is a nuclear threshold state, which basically means that it's, for all intents and purposes, a political decision rather than a technical challenge away from producing a nuclear weapon, should it so choose. Now, people who have looked at this have described Iran's nuclear program essentially as a negotiating weapon rather than a physical weapon. In other words, that Iran is hoping to use this as leverage to ensure that sanctions are lifted and that it's no longer, you know, subject to this campaign of maximum pressure by the U.S. And its allies. As you just suggested, that calculation may now change. In other words, not only have the Iranians, from their point of view, negotiated in good faith and failed to produce an agreement, because first the U.S. unilaterally renounced the Iran nuclear agreement in 2018, and now it's fully supporting an Israeli war of aggression against Iran and even on the cusp of joining itself, but also the belief that a nuclear weapon is the ultimate guarantor of security. And I suspect there will be many loud voices within Iran calling on the leadership to cross this Rubicon once this conflict is over, and assuming they survive it. Even if they don't survive it, it may well be the ambition of the next Iranian leadership. I don't think we're there yet, but we're certainly very much closer to that than we ever have been.
I'm speaking with Muin Rabbani. Marjorie Taylor Greene, of all people, posted a timeline of all these, historical timeline of all these proclamations that Iran is on the verge of acquiring a nuclear weapon. It goes back years and years and years. They've been saying the same thing, weeks, months, days away. And now U.S. intelligence says they're really nowhere near. Trump says that's nonsense. Israel says, you know, imminent. Where are they, actually?
Well, I think you can look at this in two ways. First, you have those who take an ideological approach to this, whose assessment of Iran's nuclear program reflects their own agendas and their own ambitions in the region and so on. And these are assessments that essentially have nothing to do with reality. Here I'm talking about Israel. I'm talking about its Amen corner in Washington and in the U.S. Congress and media and so on. And as you mentioned, these are people who now for several decades have basically said, if we don't bomb Iran by this evening, it will have a nuclear arsenal tomorrow morning. Then you have specialists, experts in non-proliferation and nuclear technology and nuclear weapons development and so on. And it's important to point out that these are people who are basing themselves on an extraordinary level of detail that is available about Iran's nuclear program, because Iran, unlike Israel, has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran, unlike Israel, accepts intrusive inspections and monitoring of its nuclear program by the International Atomic Energy Agency. As a result of the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, Iran accepted the most intrusive monitoring and inspections and verification regime in history since the nuclear age began in the 1940s. And what all these specialists, without exception, have been saying is Iran has a comprehensive nuclear program that has transformed Iran into a nuclear threshold state. In other words, that because of the developments in this program, the development of an atomic weapon by Iran is now basically would be the result of a political decision, much more than it would be the result of significant technical challenges. But what most of these people are also saying is that Iran became a nuclear threshold state in response to the unilateral renunciation of the nuclear agreement by the United States in 2018. In other words, had the United States stuck with the JCPOA, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But somehow that is all the fault and responsibility of Iran, and the U.S. is as innocent and angelic as Israel is.
What is Israel's goal? Is it regime change? They can't destroy the most hardened Iranian nuclear facilities without U.S. help. Is that really not their aim, and they would rather just take out the government?
Israel's objective, strategic objective, is at least regime change and perhaps even state collapse. Because again, returning to all these experts who we were just discussing a moment ago, what they have been saying and what they've been saying for years now is that the Iranian nuclear program is sufficiently developed that even if you'd successfully destroy all of its nuclear facilities, it can rapidly reconstitute its nuclear program and would still retain the capacity for nuclearization. In other words, you need to take out the regime that would make a political decision to reconstitute that program and pursue nuclearization. And if you look at the scale and scope of the Israeli campaign against Iran that began last week on the 13th of June, it goes very, very far beyond any effort to dismantle Iran's nuclear program. It's basically seeking to take out the regime, and it was seeking a decapitation strike, similar to what it conducted against Hezbollah last year. The difference here being that Iran is not an insurgent movement, is not a political movement. It's a coherent state and is capable of a much more powerful capacity for retaliation. But Israel now is already saying, you know, that even getting rid of Iran's nuclear program is not enough. We also need to get rid of Iran's ballistic missile program and so on. And even on the nuclear side of things, Israel does not have the capacity to take out the most important installation in Iran, which is a Fordow nuclear enrichment plant, which is buried deep underground. And so that's also part of the campaign to mobilize direct U.S. involvement, the selling point to Trump being one massive air raid and it's game over and you don't have to worry about getting entangled in another Iraq or Afghanistan. But it's indisputably regime change. And we should recall that Iran's former regime, the Pahlavi regime, the Shah, was one of Israel's closest strategic allies in the region. And when he was overthrown, this was a massive strategic defeat for Israel. And Israel's last ambassador to Iran at the time, Yuri Lubrani, actually put forward a proposal to recruit a group of royalists who, in his words, would be willing to shoot dead 10,000 Iranian demonstrators in the streets of Tehran in order to restore the Shah to power. So the idea of regime change in Iran, not necessarily restoration of Pahlavi rule, but at least getting rid of the Islamic Republic, has been an Israeli aspiration since 1979.
Now, the history of regime change, you know, Iraq, Libya, whatever, that's not very inspiring. Iran is a very big country, 92 million or so people. It would be a damn mess if they took down the regime.
It would be a massive mess. But another selling point of a U.S. war against Iran by Israel and the hawks and their various acolytes is that the regime is so hated, so detested by the people of Iran that once they feel it's weak, they will rise up and overthrow the regime. And so therefore, you don't have to worry about a scenario similar to Iraq. You may remember three words, cakewalk and rice and flowers. Well, how did that turn out? And what we also need to understand is that Iran is actually a much more heterogeneous society than Iraq or Syria. I mean, it's often referred to as Persia, but Persians constitute, I think, less than half of the people of Iran. Also very large populations of Kurds, an Arab minority, Baluchis, Azeris, and so on. And so the capacity for chaos and disintegration in Iran is extremely substantial. I'm not saying it's certain, but it's certainly there if you have not only regime change, but state collapse. And I would argue this is, in fact, an objective of those who are waging war against Iran now.
Although 92 million people existing in the state of chaos, that could be very dangerous for its neighbors.
Well, it would be, I think, a danger first and foremost to those within Iran's borders.
Yes, of course.
But, you know, if the letters ISIS mean anything to you, it would certainly be a huge risk and potential threat to its neighbors as well. I mean, bearing in mind, you know, that you have minorities in areas of Iran that have been supported by neighboring states. And part of the reason, I think, that Iran was seen to have been so deeply penetrated on the 13th of June is only partially because of the Israeli intelligence service's acumen, but that it was able to recruit people from these insurgent groups. Iran is a much bigger, much more populous state than Iraq, and much more heterogeneous society than Iraq. And those who believe that Iran is going to be a piece of cake compared to Iraq are exactly the same people who 20 years ago were telling us that Iraq would be a cakewalk. Of course, we don't know how this is going to end, but I just gave the example of conservative Arab monarchies in the Persian Gulf who have come to view Israel less as a vital security partner and more as a regional arsonist. The idea that this is not going to end up as a massive regional conflict, that it is not going to cause massive dislocation within Iran and in neighboring states, those are actually extraordinarily irresponsible assumptions to make, given what we know about Iran, what we know about Israel, what we know about the United States, and what we know about the Middle East. And one makes them at extraordinary peril. And I think the reason we're having this discussion now is because no one was ever held accountable for what happened in Iraq, and because Israel has convinced itself that it can do anything it pleases with total impunity because it will never be confronted with consequences for its actions.
What are Iran's options? They're causing distress in Israel, but they can actually win the war or at least avoid losing?
What I suspect Iran's approach is to seek to persuade the United States, more than Israel, of the prohibitive cost of continuing on the current path. I don't think Iran has the illusion that it can persuade Israel to cease and desist. I think its strategy is to compel the U.S. to force Israel to cease and desist by inflicting growing levels of damage on Israel and by demonstrating that it has the capacity to retaliate fiercely and effectively and very damagingly should the U.S. Join this war. By all accounts, you know, they may be succeeding in inflicting significant damage, but the strategy does not appear to be working. I think most people who are looking at the situation today would conclude, hopefully incorrectly, but would be concluding that U.S. direct participation in an attack on Iran is now inevitable.
And then finally, what about Israel? How long can it keep carrying on? They're not really prosecuting existing wars, but starting new ones. How many fronts are they fighting on now? It's hard to keep count. Can this go on forever?
I think Israel has become addicted to war. It's becoming increasingly difficult to conceive of an Israel that is not at war. And Israel, again, with its constant rhetoric about the dangers of a nuclear Iran, it's the drunken sailor slurring his way through a speech about sobriety and then getting applauded for his insights by a Western audience. It's really too much for words.
By the guys paying the bar tab.
Yeah, exactly. And, what's next? Well, if Iran is denuclearized, do we then see potentially a joint Israeli-Indian campaign to denuclearize Pakistan because it's an Islamic bomb? Where does this end? As far as I can see, it doesn't end.
That was Moeen Rabbani, who is, among many things, co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine on Middle Eastern affairs. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. The great pianist Alfred Brendel, someone whose work I've loved for years, died on June 17, age 94. Here's a bit of him playing Franz Schubert's Impromptu No. 2, No. 946 in the Deutsche catalog of his works. That was some of Schubert's Impromptu No. 2, or Klavierstück, performed by Alfred Brendel, who died the other day. Next, a close-up look at Israel. What drives its aggressive behavior? What kind of society produces these episodes of extraordinary violence? Here with some answers is Joel Shalit. Joel grew up in Israel and the U.S. and has deep familial ties to the heritage of labor Zionism. Joel is editor of The Battleground, which aims to be a voice of calm truth-telling on European society and politics. His books include Israel vs. Utopia, The Anti-Capitalism Reader, and Jerusalem Calling. In the interview, we talk some about Zev Jabotinsky and the movement he founded in the 1920s, Revisionist Zionism. Once a minority in the Zionist movement, it was characterized by maximalist demands to settle the whole of Greater Israel, rather than just the bits the early settlers colonized. Its descendants now are the dominant political force in Israel. Joel Shalit.
Just after October 7th, we were chatting, and you said Bibi's ultimate goal was Iran. I wasn't convinced at the time, but by God, you were right. So what exactly is that goal? It's looking like regime change is the goal, but how do you read what the intention of the Israeli government is?
Bibi needed cover for his ethnic cleansing campaign in Gaza. The PR for the war, particularly in Europe, has been so bad, with European heads of state starting to threaten Israel with various different kinds of sanctions. The Spanish, for example, are proposing an arms embargo. The EU is talking about ending the association agreement with Israel. He needed a just war that everybody could get behind. And so one of the many reasons, but at least the one at the top of my mind right now, is the fact that this is a good war that all of Israel's allies in the West can sign on to and help bury the bad press of Gaza.
But then what's the goal? Is it regime change?
They don't know, to be quite frank, what regime change would amount to in Iran. even though Israel possesses fantastic intel on Iran, it doesn't understand Iranian politics and what comes next. It has a very transactional view of what a war with Iran consists of, and at least in terms of the talking heads representing the Israeli government in this conflict, they don't seem to be pointing to any potential replacement governments that could follow, though there are, of course, lots of Iranian communities that have worked with Israel over the years to try to destabilize the Shiite regime.
If they depose the regime, which certainly isn't guaranteed, but what then? I mean, previous examples of regime change, Iraq, Libya, are certainly not inspiring, and Iran is a much bigger country than either of those, so they could have just a gigantic mess on their hands.
That's what they're going to get. And in the same way that Israel could not engineer a Christian-led government in Lebanon in the early 1980s, it won't be able to determine who takes over from the mullahs today. This is the problem. I mean, the only alternative government that Israel has ever worked with was the Shah. And there is nothing approximating the Shah in terms of an alternative political figure in Iran that could take over and pick up where the Shah's regime left off with Israel.
Well, people are talking about restoring the Shah's son to the throne, which seems fanciful and lunatic.
The Shah's family is so marginal at this point. That's just disinformation. There are a lot of wealthier Iranians, I'm sure, who would prefer to step into the void if indeed a void is created, and then we'll just have to see what happens. I mean, the history of Israel being able to change the political complexion of its neighbors or its, you know, other countries in the region is actually quite poor. And so on that basis alone, I don't see anything happening other than chaos. The talk of regime change is not a serious proposal. It's just to irritate the Iranians and make the government feel as though it has no legitimacy.
The kinds of targets they're attacking, though, do suggest regime change is their aim.
They want to turn the country upside down, but they don't have an idea of who they want to lead it.
You said a little while ago that the Israelis have no good sense of Iranian society or politics. They really do have very impressive military intelligence, but do they not pay much attention to society? I mean, the CIA was always very deeply involved in studying societies as well as military configurations. Are they just not interested, not capable of understanding foreign societies?
There are epistemic problems with the way Israel views its neighbors and understands their politics outside of the security sphere. This is, you know, the number one problem in Israeli politics in general regarding Israeli politics. So they more or less replicate that in their understanding of the outside world.
Could you elaborate on that?
Israel only views the outside world as being something that can contribute to how Israel ideally must function internally in the Middle East. And otherwise, it has no use for its neighbors. It wants to make money. It wants to have trade. It wants to be affluent and a decider on the world stage, but only insofar as it can help Israel continue on the path that it's been on since 1948.
And it only gets more isolated over time.
That's right. Exactly. And it's astonishing how provincial Israelis can be. And they get worse. The Netanyahu years have not been kind to Israel or to the cosmopolitanism that once characterized Israeli society, the kind that I grew up with as a kid, where your parents speak like 10 different languages and maybe have a degree or two. That kind of intellectual culture typical of diaspora Jews that was brought to Israel by immigration doesn't exist to the same degree. And it's really shocking how when you encounter Israelis abroad, even when they're at their most countercultural, like into rave culture, into alternative medicines, organic farming, you get them talking about multiculturalism or woke politics, and they sound just like Donald Trump. Israeli political identity and Israeli cultural affluence has changed a lot since the end of the 1990s and the crisis of the peace process that Netanyahu was key in destroying.
It's been remarkable to watch the change of attitudes in the U.S. over the last few years. The polls are really turning against Israel, younger people especially. The United States was Israel's last friend in the world, you could say, and that seems to be a rocky relationship. The bombs keep flowing, the money keeps flowing, but it will only get more isolated over time.
And Israelis like me who live abroad have never felt more isolated abroad.
Do people shun you?
Yeah. Not consistently, but it does happen, and it's gotten worse since October 7th, especially on the left. And it's understandable that, you know, I have Middle Eastern colleagues who are of Arab background and an Iranian background who won't talk to me anymore, not because of anything I've said, but just because I am an Israeli citizen. And I get that. What we've done is terrible. It reminds me a lot of the way that we used to shun. My memory goes back to the 1970s when I was a little kid. I remember my parents shunning Germans. They just simply cannot talk to them. That was very common in a lot of Ashkenazi families like mine that I met in the United States at the time, who like would not buy German cars. We'll go to Europe, but we won't visit Germany. There is deep resentment over the Palestinian situation, particularly over the last 2 years, and that's coming out in all kinds of ways. And I don't begrudge anybody for being uncomfortable around me for that reason, even though I'm a person of the left. But, you know, you talk to most people these days about whether there is an Israeli left, and people laugh. You just have to kind of roll with the punches and hope that there will be other people to talk to and collaborate with in the future.
Israel has flattened Gaza, killed scores of thousands, yet the number of Hamas fighters is about what it was on October 6, 2023. They're at war with like five countries. How long can this go on?
As long as the Americans pay for it.
So they couldn't pay for it themselves?
No way. Absolutely not. If you look at the equipment deliveries that the Americans have made to Israel since October 7th, that's all equipment, ammunition, et cetera, that we could not build or source ourselves independently of the United States. Israel looks all over the world for gear and has since October 7th to replenish its stocks. But at the end of the day, the Americans contribute probably over 80%.
It's hard to read what Trump is up to here. There's some mix of support with plausible deniability, which isn't too plausible as they keep sending money and bombs. Israel must be running through its weapons inventory like crazy. They can't destroy the nuclear facilities without American bombs. If regime changes the attention, that may be less urgent. But what do you make of all this?
The Israeli campaign in Iran is multifaceted, and it serves as many domestic purposes as it does international. For Netanyahu, there's a tremendous sense of victory in terms of what the IDF was able to accomplish in Lebanon and Syria. And both countries, of course, benefited enormously from Iranian patronage, which gave Israel enormous security grief over the years. And there is a sense that if Israel can rearrange those two countries or contribute to the rearranging of Syria and Lebanon, it might as well take the war finally to the Iranians themselves at home. And the Americans have been willing to pay for that. As has been the case in the past, various American governments tend to look at Israel as a subcontractor that can help keep the peace in the region or work as an American enforcer in the region. During the 2006 Lebanon war, in which the Bush administration actively goaded Israel to go to war, partially because of what was going on in Iraq at the time. In the same sense, the Trump administration sees Israel and the Israeli military as a proxy that can help keep the peace in the Middle East, so to speak, when and where it's needed. And I think the Americans have, to a certain extent, authorized this campaign on this basis.
They've got a funny idea of keeping the peace. They've started, like, what, five wars?
There's a lot of anger at Iran in international diplomatic circles in the West because of the degree to which it's collaborated with the Russians in the Ukraine war. Regardless of what we think about that, making the Iranians feel very uncomfortable like this gets a general sign-off, I think, partially because of Ukraine. That doesn't necessarily take Israel out of the hot seat regarding the Palestinians. The French, for example, will, on the one hand, say they'll support Israel in the event that it cannot handle its fight with the Iranians. But on the other hand, they will also say that they would like to, or they're exploring the idea of supporting a Palestinian state or Palestinian statehood. Bibi isn't getting everything he wants from the West in terms of support for this war, but he is getting something which he has not had over Gaza in a while. And so this is a big driver of the conflict. Separately, the Gaza war is really devastating for Israel diplomatically and politically. And a war with Iran, which trundles out all the same complaints about the Iranians that the Israelis have always had, such as that it has an active nuclear weapons program, which U.S. intelligence says it does not have, at least to the degree that Israel has alleged it exists, has given Israel more or less cover to argue that it is fighting a just war in Iran, a war for Israel's own existence. And unfortunately, there is a certain degree of buy-in to that because of the history of bad relations between Israel and Iran. Like, no one got in the way or complained about Israel's massive aerial campaigns in Syria over the last decade targeting Iranian assets in Hezbollah. For Netanyahu, this is a PR campaign. This is a get-out-of-jail campaign as far as Gaza is concerned. And if Israel delivers a completely neutralized Iran, maybe the EU and the United States will collaborate in stalling the ICJ case against him. Lots of considerations like that go into this war. Israeli foreign policy is largely dictated by Netanyahu's own personal interest. Netanyahu sees himself as the state, and what's good for him is good for Israel, even when it's bad for Israel. And this war is really bad for Israel.
That l'état de sounds very much like Trump.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm speaking with Joel Shalit. This is a little off topic, but I just watched this propaganda video for the IDF that claimed that Iran's goals are not just the destruction of Israel, but the destruction of the U.S., China, and Germany, and they listed several other countries as well. It was just really crude and stupid propaganda. What's wrong with them? Can't they do better?
Netanyahu is very nostalgic, and the Israeli security apparatus, to the degree that it coincides with Netanyahu, is really nostalgic for the war on terror and the popularization of Islamophobia during that time. Yet it doesn't understand Iranian politics to the degree that it can't resell that narrative now, which is what it's trying to do. I mean, all of these alleged conspiracies that you hear in propaganda like that betray a profound misunderstanding of Iranian society and Iranian politics, which can't even properly qualify it as a fundamentalist threat to the West.
But also, like, foreign audiences, like someone in the U.S. or, you know, Germany looking at this is like, I'm not really convinced here.
Yes, I agree with you. And I think this war will backfire in terms of international public opinion in the same way that the Gaza war has. And that will only isolate Israel further. I can't see the Americans betraying Netanyahu and letting something happen to him and his government. I think the Americans will continue to protect the current Israeli government and the regime that it's bringing into place, the so-called post-democratic Israel. And Israel will just further dig itself into a sort of a psychological state that it simply cannot comprehend why people have issues with the country politically.
Well, it's anti-Semitism.
Of course. This is the only thing we can say.
The war in Gaza has been somewhat occluded by the latest round of attacks on Iran. They're still bombing. They're still shooting people as they approach aid trucks. What is the ultimate intention in Gaza? Do they have a plan?
Yeah, they do. I mean, if you listen to the rhetoric of Bibi's cabinet members and senior members of the overall Israeli state, it's been one of consistent incitement to genocide and ethnic cleansing. The Palestinian population as it exists in Gaza at this point, the goal is to transfer them somewhere else. Ethnic transfer has been a big ticket item in the Israeli right for years now, and public opinion more or less supports the transfer of Gaza's population elsewhere. I've heard talk of the Americans underwriting the transfer to countries like Libya.
Libya doesn't have enough problems as it is.
No, of course not. And ironically, it isn't even a country really at this point. Dumping the Palestinian population in Libya is yet another form of cruelty and another assertion of their statelessness in a state that has no functioning institutions of any kind. My sense is that given what we've done in Gaza already in terms of destroying Gazan society and Gaza's civil infrastructure and Gaza's housing stock, that it's not beyond Israel to, of course, transfer the population when it's finished. It's a terrible situation, but everything that we've done to date suggests that we will do this, and it's just a matter of when.
Yeah, I mean, there's really nothing left. I mean, it's impossible to sustain a civilization in Gaza in its current physical state.
Gaza doesn't exist anymore. the fact that they replaced the UN with this private foundation that is more or less consists of private military contractors from the United States serving soup to starving Palestinians who get shot on the way to pick up their food. It's a farce. It's a complete farce. The level of cruelty that we have exhibited in Gaza speaks reams about the dysfunctionality of Israeli society and the kind of competition and the kind of mean-spiritedness that exists in Israeli society, despite how much Israeli culture and Israeli society gets love from Israelis themselves more than other states the Jews have lived in.
I read an article the other day that started from the premise that lots of people want to leave Israel. It's curious that that seemed like almost the default position, what people want to leave. But they talked to four people who wanted to stay. And of those four, most of them seemed to want to leave too, but they just didn't. So they talked to four of these holdouts. And one of them recounted taking her dog to a park and talking to someone who just casually asked, how should we deal with Gaza? Nuke them or just starve them? And she asked, you know, what kind of country is this that this passes for a casual conversation? Indeed, what kind of country is this?
This is the Israel of the Netanyahu era. This is the Israel of a repeat mowing the lawn operations in Gaza since 2007, 2009. I can't keep all the operations properly indexed anymore. We have gone through a period of renewed dehumanization of Palestinians during this era, and it has been a cultural program that has been repeatedly drilled into us through military conflict and cultural warfare in Israel itself. And at this point, given the state of Israeli media, which was at one point pretty good, the television networks, the newspapers, with the exception of platforms like Haaretz and 972, which are fantastic, has created a new consensus in Israeli society that is completely nationalist to the core. And it's hard to argue for any kind of alternative political position other than that of the current government. A government which has more or less, with one 2-year break, been in power consistently since 2009.
It is obviously Bibi's Israel, but how much of this is traceable to the origins of the country? It began with the Nakba. Was this just a process of evolution or devolution, or was there a break somewhere along the line? How do you read that?
That's a really good question. We had a break in the 1990s created by the peace process, whose roots really start in the war, in the first Lebanon war in 1982, and public disaffection over the war. And it created a huge space for talking about Israeli identity and Israeli politics and Israeli culture, which was quite healthy for a brief period. But the right-wing pushback against the peace process to boil down a very complex process into something sort of fairly short and undetailed was successful, starting with the assassination of Rabin. And Rabin was no saint, but Netanyahu and the forces that he was able to marshal in Israeli society staged a successful counter-revolution against what the peace process might have bequeathed Israel politically, and normalized the revisionist point of view in Israeli politics, which many Israeli liberals and leftists underestimated during the peace process period of Oslo. That somehow the right-wing politics of Likud, of the Irgun, of Jabotinsky, of Trumpeldor was just as important to Israel's political identity and historical identity as European and American liberalism of the kind that tried to reassert itself during the 90s. Netanyahu had a lot to work with. I mean, he really understood the ultimate conservative continuum that had characterized Israeli politics since 1948, if not earlier, the kind that was, you know, colonialist, the kind that was proactively anti-democratic, the kind that has no problem eliminating Palestinian society again with a second Nakba. This is something I think that the secular Ashkenazi elite really misunderstood about Israeli society during that period. And I count myself amongst that community that failed to get it. And I remember starting to figure it out after Rabin was assassinated, particularly as I got to know the settler community better and the fact that the once fetishized Mizrahi community had gone completely to the right and towards ultra-Orthodoxy as well. Israel has always been a nationalist project and a right-wing nationalist project to a large degree, despite its socialist origins. The issue was what direction it would take. And I think Netanyahu and Ariel Sharon and that entire milieu of Likudniks managed to steer the country in a far-right direction in such a way that no other kind of politics could get fostered at a state level successfully.
It seems like Jabotinsky was a minority among the Zionists years ago, has eventually won.
Oh, absolutely. Revisionist Zionism and what you call separately national religion in Israel are the norm today. And Israel is characterized by increasing levels of what they call Haredization, the growth of the ultra-Orthodox community and the normalization of Haredi culture in Israeli civil society. Everything has trended conservative, and there has been no effective break from imposed on that by Israeli neoliberalism and Israeli secularism. Neoliberalism is dying a terrible death in Israel right now because of the Gaza war and because of the overall civic culture that Netanyahu has fostered since 2009, and can't do anything other than move business offices offshore to protect the affluence that it once injected into Israeli society, the tech firms. A year and a half ago, I even had an Israeli family looking at buying an apartment in my building here in Torino. And I asked them, you know, they're from Kfar Saba, which is a sort of a, you know, mythical liberal suburb of Tel Aviv. And I said, why do you want to move here? And they said, Bibi, you know, we need to be able to work. We need to be able to do business. The economy is going to go completely overboard because of the Gaza war.
That was the Israeli-American journalist Joel Shalit. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this. Some more from Alfred Brendel, who died the other day. This is the conclusion of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 32. Till next week, bye.